This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
One of the greatest challenges is how do we disconnect economic growth from externalities or emissions growth? How do we grow without creating more pollution?
Socially responsible capitalism. Is this an oxymoron? Not according to this week's guest on Sea Change Radio. Graham Sinclair is a South African sustainable investment consultant and the president of the Africa Sustainable Investment Forum. Money managers like him attract conscientious investors using the tools of capitalism to pressure corporations to be more socially responsible. Today, Sinclair talks about the past and future of sustainable investing and what it means for corporations, investors, and consumers. We also discuss the particular importance of socially responsible investment strategies in developing countries. Next on Sea Change Radio. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Graham Sinclair. He's a principal at Cinco, which is a sustainable investment consulting firm, as well as the president of AfricaSIF.org, which is a Africa Sustainable Investment Forum. Graham, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much, Alex.
Can you define socially responsible investing for us, Graham?
Sure. So my approach to sustainable investment is an investment practice that explicitly integrates environmental, social, and governance factors, ESG factors, while looking for long-term sustainable investment performance. I choose not to use the word responsible. I choose to use the word sustainable. For me, that has a better context of some of the developing the investment case or the business case for managing other people's money by integrating ESG factors.
A lot of companies, mutual funds in the States, have begun to call their funds a green or socially responsible investing funds when they just stay away from tobacco or firearms or some of these other issues that people may have a problem with from a moral standpoint or from a sustainability standpoint. How does your approach differ?
There's some philosophical underpins to the approach that I have and that I use in the shop. One is that we're investors first. So you can find many people coming to sustainable investment or responsible investment or ethical investment. They come from different places. The place that we come from is investors first. We're hugely mindful that we're stewards of other people's money. So that infuses the philosophy or the approach. Secondly, that at any point in time, any activity, an investment activity, is best when it's a longer term proposition. And thirdly, that at any point in time, there are positive and negative externalities generated just in the course of the economics of the marketplace. Our encouragement is that when investment happens, that the negative externalities are properly priced and therefore properly priced into the investment case. And the final piece of philosophy is around the fact that our approach to describing the marketplace is at any point in time, ESG factors are at play in the investment case. The better question is, why haven't people been properly pricing those in for so many years? Now, to your reference to what's in a portfolio, what's not in a portfolio, for us, that's simply a matter of how much you want to put on the label or not put on the label. So in summary, our position is that there are ESG factors at play. The question is, how well have you looked at them and how well have you reflected them in your investment case? And there is an opportunity for those funds or portfolios or marketers that want to put ESG labeling on the label, you know, call it a hybrid, call it a green, call it ethical, then that's, you know, it's fine if they choose to do that.
You're also president of AfricaSIF.org, the Sustainable Investment Forum. So you're probably better suited to talk about some of the unique challenges that Africa faces and African companies face in trying to present a socially responsible investment package to potential investors. Can you tell us some of the unique issues facing your continent?
Yeah, Alex, we face a lot of challenges. And the first challenge, and frankly, thank you for choosing to do this interview. One of the first challenges we face, and here speaking as president of AfricaSIF.org, we face a challenge of just misinformation or outdated ideas about Africa. Many people don't understand that Africa is not a place, it's 54 countries. Africa as a geographic entity can include all of China, all of the US, and a bunch of other countries in its geographical space. It's huge. So my first comment would be there's nearly 1 billion Africans. I'm very nervous of trying to stereotype or simplify what I see. I'm just speak as one African in my role as president of AfricaSIF.org.
Or maybe just South Africa. Let's focus on South Africa.
Sure. And from my work and the work of AfricaSIF.org, the people we're talking to, the people in the investment value chain, in many ways, what played out just recently around COP17, this issue of how much of the responsibility to put on developing countries for global emissions, for example, neatly presents the conundrum. The conundrum, for example, for South Africa, the largest economy in Africa, G20 economy, but also one of the largest emitters as a country on the planet. The challenge is you still have a large poor or lower middle income society looking to develop. They're looking to own their first home. They're looking to own their first toaster and TV, first car. There's a large kind of consumption wave that is yet to play out in Africa, and that will be based on whatever the infrastructure that is then made available. So challenges in Africa for investing sustainably cross the spectrum. And one of the greatest challenges is how do we disconnect economic growth from externalities or emissions growth? How do we grow without creating more pollution?
And how do we grow in terms of that framework of ESG and still have a chance to lift some of these people out of the poverty, the cycle that they've been caught in for generations? Do you think that there is a way out through socially responsible investing?
Yes, absolutely, Alex. And the proposition behind AfricaSIF is that we're trying to be a virtual but a personal network of the investment value chain active in Africa. We've got people who are connecting to us outside of Africa and inside of Africa. Look, job one is to get people investing in Africa. The best thing someone can do if they have a vision for growth in developing markets is to trade there, is to invest there, is to engage the people who live there and make stuff and provide services, engage them, include them in the global economy. That's job one. I think job two, and this is what AfricaSIF.org is mindful of, is that there's lots of capital that's very, very interested in Africa in this century. The question mark, though, is what agendas does that capital have? We know Africa's got a very difficult history, but it keeps getting better. The more Africans are engaged and the more people are transparent about what their agendas are, and also that Africans start getting smarter and voicing what we would like to see happen on our continent and what we would like to see happen in our countries. So the best thing that we can do is to attract investors, and when those investors come, we are explicit and clear about the environmental, social, and corporate governance factors that they're going to need to think through and make decisions around.
How can ESG investing give the downtrodden in your country, South Africa, a bigger voice, or can it?
You know, that's a big ask, and my own view is that sometimes investors are rather conservative. They're kind of at the back, if you will. Sometimes companies are doing great work well ahead of investors. Media organizations, civic organizations, NGOs doing great work. The government, too, is quite involved. I think investors making capital available to invest in Africa is a very positive dynamic. But knowing and being very clear about where that money goes and how those investment decisions are made and what ESG factors are included, I think that's what we need. That kind of smart next generation investing, I think that could be very, very positive for Africa.
Follow the shift to sustainability with SeaChange Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking with Graham Sinclair. He's a sustainable investment consultant based out of Cape Town, South Africa. Graham, can you take us back a little bit in history to the beginnings of ESG or socially responsible investment? Investing. When did the idea hatch and when did it really start to take off?
There's been traces back. One could even infer some of the kind of the faith-based communities had certain restrictions about how one should or should not proceed as a steward of one's finances. So in some ways, you can tie it all the way back to there. I think in the 1700s, 1800s, the Quakers, for example, were very clear about not wanting their money to fund certain types of businesses, particularly based on their stance around peace and so not funding wars of some kinds. I think more formally in the institutional investment space, we've seen it operating most effectively since 1971. PAX, mutual fund in the US, launched the first ever mutual fund that explicitly had these factors involved. And then through the 80s, various issues played out, and South Africa here played a role as on account of the anti-apartheid movement and the screens to exclude that. And the very, very many other pieces, the tobacco issue played out, asbestos and so on. So very much in the 70s and 80s, you had your kind of classic social responsible investment space, mostly characterized by negative screens, what you should not choose to do. And that's the era when, for example, KLD developed the KLD 400 from 1st of May 1990. It's one of the longest running ever sustainability indexes tracking ESG factors of 400 companies in the US. Rolling forward then through the 90s, there's various new ideas or iterations about what is possible, partly driven by the new Rio Sustainable Development Agenda from 1992. Into the 2000s, where sustainability issues and ESG factors start to play out more directly, and you found, for example, law firms, investment banks, sell-side research shops, more and more interested in issues, including one that I've done some work on around obesity. Back in 2002, UBS actually put out a sell-side analyst report that said obesity could be the next tobacco, flagging the issue as a major strategy issue for the food and beverage industry. And through to this decade now, where there's really a sophisticated range across different asset classes of different approaches to sustainable investment, whether you're looking at fixed income or real estate or equities or global emerging markets portfolios or US large cap portfolios, there's a number of different approaches to how one can integrate ESG factors into the sustainable investment theme.
Talk about how the resource curse informs your portfolio. We maybe take a step back and talk about what the resource curse is.
Sure. The resource curse is something that was flagged a couple of decades back, and there's been some influential writing over years by economists, including through the World Bank, and sometimes called the Dutch disease. It's a situation where a country will discover one major resource, typically an extractive industry, an oil, a mineral, and then the whole economy structurally kind of sways and fits behind that and looks to fulfill that as the key goal. And And then, in, for example, in the Dutch situation, the 70s, kind of letting manufacturing go, or in a situation, particularly in a country where you may have weak enforcements of rules, you could have situations for corruptions or issues where a few elite, whether political or private sector, a few elite come to enrich themselves and doesn't improve the country as a whole. I think in Africa's 54 countries, you'll find a mixed history of how that's played out. One of my first reminders, though, to people in this space is a corrupt relationship, of course, relies on two parties, the party offering and the party receiving. I'm mindful here that Siemens is now picking up contracts in the U.S. At the government level, and Siemens was implicated in a number of corrupt contracts in Africa. I think there have been very positive initiatives, for example, the voluntary investor initiatives or banking initiatives like the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, which has companies explicitly declaring what facilitations or advisory payments they're making and to whom. I think initiatives like that are really, really good. But we're mindful. One is a little nervous. Ghana just had a great oil discovery. They started pumping end of 2010. And yeah, one does have a little question mark and a worry to make sure that that runs really well, that doesn't affect, you know, a new and emerging and a strong African economy like Ghana. Well respected, the first place President Obama chose to speak on the African continent, in sub-Saharan Africa at least. And yet it is possible that corporations run well, that governments run well, but we need to be very watchful. And I think transparency and good governance is a key part of that.
And let's talk about returns, since you said that your primary focus is essentially to be a caretaker of other people's money and to try to make it into more money. Since all of your investments have an ESG angle, can you stack up some of the larger funds that have an SRI? Socially responsible investment fund, and then they have their non-social angle. How do they usually, in a vacuum, stack up to each other?
In terms of performance studies, Alex, I teach an MBA masterclass in sustainable investment. I do that around the world, and I always kind of take the MBA students. You can imagine how challenging they are, and I kind of take them carefully through this performance issue. The first issue around performance is you got to be very clear on like for like, right? Are you comparing apples with apples or apples with some kind of fruit salad? And very easy in an investment context that the attribution of why one portfolio outperformed another can be mistaken for factors that it's not directly linked to. So this issue of performance attribution, can you directly tie back to the ESG performance, environment, social, governance factor performance of a portfolio, is a really, really tough thing to do. And frankly, it's kind of like a frontier of where sustainable investment is. People around the world are trying to figure out the impact metrics and the performance attribution. So that's just at a conceptual level. At the level of actual numbers, I have seen more than 30 different studies over different time periods, different countries, different asset classes. For me, it's a bit of a wash. There's so many factors. There's a lot of noise in the portfolio performance. It's really hard to drill down and say one ESG factor helped a portfolio or portfolio or portfolios outperform. So what I am very comfortable to say in any public situation is adding ESG factors will not necessarily lead to underperformance. In fact, some studies show it has led to outperformance. A most recent one released in September of this year in Europe, study was done in Europe and in the US using data from a leading provider of ESG data. They found up to 130 basis points, that's 1.3% outperformance over 5 years. But again, I am very nervous of talking to the performance issue other than to say there are many factors that go in determining investment performance. Our philosophical proposition is that the investment case that includes ESG factors is a smarter, more insightful look at the underlying companies or investment projects in a portfolio, and that should, over the longer term, lead to better returns or less risk of underperformance, which, as an investment professional, one would know, sometimes it's just protecting from the disasters or the blow-ups in your portfolio that gives you the great performance, not necessarily shooting the lights out. Don't get me wrong. You can have a great company. That's a bad investment. Alternatively, you could have a bad company. That's a good investment in terms of numbers being, you know, red or green, up or down. So it's just a really complex space. But there's no doubt that for the sustainability proposition, the business case for sustainability is that you'll be able to attract better talent, which you'll need in a faster moving world where you need more agile companies. You need a great reputation that your clients love you and they talk to their best friends about you, which reduces then your marketing costs or increases your lifetime sale, for example. And then let's not underscore the press from regulators or politicians as they come to realize more and more that there are major demographic changes, the major sustainability thematic challenges like water stress or climate change or resource scarcity, these are all going to impact the way societies succeed or fail in the century to come.
To tell me what was on his mind, and he said, "But honey, yes, but honey, but honey, if you wanna stay here with me, I was clean as a screen and so hard pressed. I called the woman that I love best. I finally got my baby by the half past three. She said." To know what you want with me, I said, "My honey, my honey."
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Graham Sinclair. He's a sustainable investment consultant based in Cape Town, South Africa. Graham, what are some of the new sectors of the sustainable investment space that have you excited?
For me, I've done some work recently in the last 2 years in private equity. And I think this is very interesting for your listeners. Now, there's two classic models of private equity. One is financial engineering. It's the classic kind of barbarians at the gate, Nabisco situation. That's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about growth capital private equity, which is more common in emerging markets. You have a growing company. It's a family company. It's a small company. It needs to be mid-sized. It wants to grow regionally, maybe globally. It needs growth capital. Because private equity investors have control at some level, they typically have a board position, they should be in for 5 to 10 years in this Model 2 growth capital. And they have the ability to reap some of those rewards directly from improved corporate governance or improved environmental or social performance when they then sell the company. That's a very exciting asset class that I don't think many sustainable investors have properly thought through.
Graham, what are some of the challenges you face having a small but global firm in terms of picking your portfolios, and how do you compete?
You know, there's two classic pieces to investment management. There's, you know, making buy-sell decisions, and then there's the advice, the strategy that sits around that. We are what we like to call sustainable investment architects. We don't make buy or sell decisions. We don't choose portfolios, but we help to develop the thinking, the architecture, the approach that institutional investors or stock exchanges or governments or pension funds are looking to take when they make their investment decisions. So we developed that architecture. We don't actually recommend on certain buy, hold, sell decisions. And where we look to differentiate is, similar to any great architect or great architect practice, you actually work in very small teams. You're very focused. You don't do more than 5 projects at a time, which is our cap. And we focus on areas of designing and developing the investment architecture, developing sustainability indexes, which is a very, very interesting space. We work in private equity on ESG frameworks and reporting. We develop education, that's executive education, or working with graduate-type students doing internal remodeling and re-educating of investment analysts. And then finally, thematic research. We're just finishing up a paper now with Trucost out of London and New York. They do carbon modeling, and we've just looked at 10 investment funds looking at what their carbon modeling would be at two different price points. So architecture indexes, private equity, education, and thematic research is where we've targeted our shop.
How attuned are companies to this growing sector of the investment world?
I think sustainable investment as a theme is influential far beyond the size of assets that are directly managed with ESG factors. So what are the numbers? If you look at the big voluntary investor initiatives, you look at PRI, Principles for Responsible Investment, I used to work there 3 years back in Geneva. They have over 900 signatories and over 25 trillion assets under management are tied to the Principles for Responsible Investment. Secondly, Carbon Disclosure Project. They have fewer signatories, but they have a larger total of assets signed onto their initiative. I think it's maybe in the $40 to $50 trillion dollar assets under management space. More directly in emerging markets, we have estimated as Cinco, we've estimated around $450 billion is integrating ESG factors today in your major developing countries like Brazil, India, China, South Africa, Turkey, and so on. So you have a chunk of money. Now, it's never all the money. Sometimes it's maybe 20% of the money. But in other markets, for example, Europe, in France, the most recent study, it was over 50% of assets under management in some way had policies calling on them to look at ESG factors. Now, I won't speak to how well or how poorly they're executing on those philosophies or strategies, but as a space, as a theme in asset management, it is definitely growing. It is definitely growing at a decent rate, but by no means is it the largest piece. To the issue of influence, I think sustainable investment has an influence far beyond the size of its assets. Why? Because these issues are so strategic, because these issues are often headline risk issues. No CEO wants to be caught on the front page of a major newspaper around the world doing something that doesn't work. One just has to look at the most recent example out of Japan with Olympus, with that issue around the bonus payments and some shady M&A activity, and just no company wants that. And there's many, many examples like that. Because the sustainable investment community are those people asking those tough questions, checking those reports to see what the footnotes say to the 10K, sustainable investment practitioners have a very large influence, larger, I'd say, than the pure numbers that they manage today. But let me make my final point, though. We've got a major player like PIMCO out there on the West Coast, which has now joined the Principles for Responsible Investment. Mohammed Al-Aryan has some very positive things to say. So I think in many ways, the theme of integrating ESG factors is playing out the way it should. There's always going to be assets that don't care where the money came from and how they make their money. I think more and more people are going to care about how they make their money.
Graham Sinclair, principal at Cinco and also the president at AfricaSIF.org. Thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Earth, Wind, and Fire, The Gourds, and The Drifters. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.